The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Page 300, Part 2, The Yoga of the Integral Knowledge, Chapter 2, The Status of Knowledge. The Self, the Divine, the Supreme Reality, the All, the Transcendent, the One in all these aspects is then the object of yogic knowledge. Ordinary objects, the external appearances of life and matter, the psychology of our thoughts and actions, the perception of the forces of the apparent world can be part of this knowledge, but only insofar as it is part of the manifestation of the One. It becomes at once evident that the knowledge for which yoga strives must be different from what men ordinarily understand by the word. For we mean ordinarily by knowledge an intellectual appreciation of the facts of life, mind, and matter, and the laws that govern them. This is a knowledge founded upon our sense perception and upon reasoning from our sense perceptions, and it is undertaken partly for the pure satisfaction of the intellect, partly for practical efficiency, and the added power which knowledge gives in managing our lives and the lives of others, in utilizing for human ends the overt or secret forces of nature, and in helping or hurting, in saving and ennobling, or in oppressing and destroying our fellow men. Yoga, indeed, is commensurate with all life, and can include all these subjects and objects. There is even a yoga which can be used for self-indulgence as well as for self-conquest, for hurting others as well as for their salvation. Yoga develops power. It develops it even when we do not desire or consciously aim at it. And power is always a double-edged weapon which can be used to hurt or destroy as well as to help and save. Be it also noted that all destruction is not evil. But all life includes not only, not even mainly life as humanity now leads it. It envisages rather and regards as its one true object a higher, truly conscious existence, which our half-conscious humanity does not yet possess, and can only arrive at by a self-exceeding spiritual ascension. It is this greater consciousness and higher existence which is the peculiar and appropriate object of yogic discipline. This greater consciousness, this higher existence, are not an enlightened or illumined mentality supported by a greater dynamic energy or supporting a purer moral life and character. Their superiority to the ordinary human consciousness is not in degree, but in kind and essence. There is a change not merely of the surface or instrumental manner of our being, but of its very foundation and dynamic principle. Yogic knowledge seeks to enter into a secret consciousness beyond mind, which is only occultly here, concealed at the basis of all existence. For it is that consciousness alone that truly knows, and only by its possession can we possess God and rightly know the world and its real nature and secret forces. All this world, visible or sensible to us, and all too in it that is not visible, is merely the phenomenal expression of something beyond the mind and the senses. The knowledge which the senses and intellectual reasoning from the data of the senses can bring us is not true knowledge. It is a science of appearances. And even appearances cannot be properly known unless we know first the reality of which they are images. This reality is their self, and there is one self of all. When that is seized, all other things can then be known in their truth, and no longer as now, only in their appearance. It is evident that however much we may analyze the physical and sensible, we cannot by that means arrive at the knowledge of the self, or of ourselves, or of that which we call God. The telescope, the microscope, the scalpel, the retort, and alembic cannot go beyond the physical, although they may arrive at subtler and subtler truths about the physical. If then we confine ourselves to what the senses and their physical aids reveal to us, and refuse from the beginning to admit any other reality or any other means of knowledge, we are obliged to conclude that nothing is real except the physical, and that there is no self in us or in the universe, no God within or without, no ourselves even except this aggregate of brain, nerves, and body. But this we are only obliged to conclude because we have assumed it firmly from the beginning, and therefore cannot but circle round to our original assumption. If, then, there is a self, a reality, not obvious to the senses, it must be by other means than those of physical science that it is to be sought and known. The intellect is not that means. Undoubtedly, there are a number of supra-sensuous truths at which the intellect is able to arrive in its own manner, and which it is able to perceive and state as intellectual conceptions. The very idea of force, for instance, on which science so much insists, is a conception, a truth at which the intellect alone can arrive by going beyond its data. For we do not sense this universal force, but only its results. And the force itself we infer as a necessary cause of these results. So also the intellect, by following a certain line of rigorous analysis, can arrive at the intellectual conception and the intellectual conviction of the self. And this conviction can be very real, very luminous, very potent, as the beginning of other and greater things. Still, in itself, intellectual analysis can only lead to an arrangement of clear conceptions, perhaps to a right arrangement of true conceptions. But this is not the knowledge aimed at by yoga, for it is not in itself an effective knowledge. A man may be perfect in it, and yet be precisely what he was before, except in the mere fact of the greater intellectual illumination. The change of our being at which yoga aims may not at all take place. It is true that intellectual deliberation and right discrimination are an important part of the yoga of knowledge, but their object is rather to remove a difficulty than to arrive at the final and positive result of this path. Our ordinary intellectual notions are a stumbling block in the way of knowledge, for they are governed by the error of the senses, and they found themselves on the notion that matter and body are the reality, that life and force are the reality, that passion and emotion, thought and sense are the reality. And with these things we identify ourselves. And because we identify ourselves with these things, we cannot get back to the real self. Therefore, it is necessary for the seeker of knowledge to remove this stumbling block and to get right notions about himself and the world. For how shall we pursue by knowledge the real self if we have no notion of what it is and are, on the contrary, burdened with ideas quite opposite to the truth? Therefore, right thought is a necessary preliminary, and once the habit of right thought is established, free from sense error and desire and old association and intellectual prejudgment, the understanding becomes purified and offers no serious obstacle to the farther process of knowledge. Still, right thought only becomes effective when in the purified understanding, it is followed by other operations, by vision, by experience, by realization. What are these operations? They are not mere psychological self-analysis and self-observation. Such analysis, such observation are, like the process of right thought, of immense value and practically indispensable. They may even, if rightly pursued, lead to a right thought of considerable power and effectivity. Like intellectual discrimination, by the process of meditative thought, they will have an effect of purification. They will lead to self-knowledge of a certain kind, and to the setting right of the disorders of the soul and the heart, and even of the disorders of the understanding. Self-knowledge of all kinds is on the straight path to the knowledge of the real self. The Upanishad tells us that the self-existent has so set the doors of the soul that they turn outwards. And most men look outward into the appearances of things. Only the rare soul that is ripe for a calm thought and steady wisdom turns its eye inward, sees the self, and attains to immortality. To this turning of the eye inward, psychological self-observation and analysis is a great and effective introduction. We can look into the inward of ourselves more easily than we can look into the inward of things external to us, because there, in things outside us, we are, in the first place, embarrassed by the form, and secondly, we have no natural previous experience of that in them which is other than their physical substance. A purified or tranquilized mind may reflect, or a powerful concentration may discover God in the world, the self in nature, even before it is realized in ourselves. But this is rare and difficult. In one respect, however, it is easier, because in external things we are not so much hampered by the sense of the limited ego as in ourselves. One obstacle to the realization of God is therefore removed.